Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. Today, we're going to do something a little different. Now, normally, I bring on a guest, have a panel, and maybe even taking a few phone calls here and there. But today, I want to take a look back into the past. We're just about a month away from the first gubernatorial debate of the general election. It's set to take place September 28th at 7 p.m. right here on 1450 WCTC. So you got to make sure you're listening to us on that night. So remember, September 28th at 7 p.m. 1450 WCTC. So make sure you got that dial turned to us on the AM. Remember, it's 93.5 FM now on the FM dial. And of course, you can always catch us at WCTCAM.com. And it's also going to be held at the NJ PAC in Newark. The debate will be moderated by Shadade Bedarinois, Jim Gardner, Adriana Vargasino, and Amanda Hoover. It's going to be the first time incumbent Democratic Governor Phil Murphy and former Republican Assemblyman Jack Chiarelli go head-to-head. Now, this is one of two debates that are going to be put on the calendar amongst the gubernatorial candidates. The details have yet to be announced for the second one, and there's also going to be another one scheduled for the lieutenant governor candidates. So we're going to be watching all that, and of course, we will bring that all to you as we go on and as we get closer. Of course, we keep you updated on everything you need to know for this gubernatorial race, and that's why I wanted to do this special show for you today. In preparation for all of this, I wanted to give you a preview of what the race is going to look like in the weeks and months ahead. Summer, you know, it's kind of the fun time. You know, it's nice. You're going to the beach, you're going down the Jersey Shore. You're not really paying attention to politics as much. But going into the fall, that's when the campaign's going to be heating up the most. I want to show you the candidates that are going to be running, and I want to present their platforms to you. For the sake of this show and this broadcast, we're going to focus on the top three candidates. Typically, we only look at the two major party candidates, usually the Republican and the Democrat, but I want you to focus on what's happening on the Libertarian side. Libertarian candidate Greg Mealy he's really making waves, to be honest with you, especially in conservative circles, due largely to their dissatisfaction with Jack Chiarelli. After a bruising primary, many Republicans still remain skeptical of Chiarelli, with neither of his big party rivals, Hirsch Singh, nor Phil Rizzo, endorsing him after the primaries. Mealy really points to Chiarelli and Murphy as big government. So he points to them as government is the only solution they're going to give you. He touts his small government views, where he believes government needs to get out of the way and needs to give the people the control of their lives, especially when it comes to COVID-19. He's made his remarks known on that as well. He doesn't believe in mandates for masks or for vaccines, for that matter. Well, that somewhat lines up with Chiarelli, but Mealy in particular says he's the guy that's going to implement that if he's elected. I had the chance to talk to him about this on this show. Take a listen. So you're running as the Libertarian candidate for governor. Why do you want to be governor?
I see a lot of problems with this state, and the policies actually between Governor Murphy and even Mr. Chiarelli are not good solutions for anything. Everybody seems to want this big government solution, and it's basically, as far as I'm concerned, it's the leading cause of death over the course of humanity is big government. So we need to go back to small government. I've actually been espousing that view for a few years now, and at this point, I think there's just been so much going in the wrong direction that way that we needed to jump in and say, this is where we need to draw the line. We need to make this change. And I couldn't sit back anymore. I had to get into the race.
You said that big government is the leading cause of death in humanity. Why do you think that? What does that mean?
It's one of our catchphrases, but basically we're referring to the fact that whenever there's been big government, socialist, communist rule, that kind of thing, that there's been nothing but misery, suffering, and death among the people, because those governments don't tend to care about their people so much. They just sort of take advantage of their position of power and leave everyone else to fight over, I guess you might call it, the scraps of life. It's time that, you know, in terms of the big government we have in our state, that the leadership start to remember that they work for the public and not vice versa.
Now, you talk about how you say big government isn't working. What would you do if elected?
Well, there are many areas where we can really try to attack the spending that's been going on. Primarily, the administrative side of the public school system has been greatly overblown with salaries and costs and multi-layers of unnecessarily administrative staff and red tape. The decisions have been taken away from the teachers in large part as to what and how to teach. And ever since even going back to the original Department of Education being formed, there's been a steady decline on the international scale between the U.S. and all of, you know, a lot of other countries as far as performance in school. And that's been part of the reason. I think if we go back to, you know, sort of pushing the responsibility down more locally in terms of teaching method and responsibility and control, whatever that might be, as well as one of our big platform planks is school choice. We're trying to get to the point where, you know, the free market competitive nature of a school offering would be very beneficial to make sure that schools either improve how they do things or they don't get the funding. I mean, basically, the funding has to follow the student, and then they can make the choice among different options to keep basically the public system versus any other charters or even private or whatever. Keep them honest. Keep them working harder to produce essentially a quality product in terms of the education they provide.
The Republican nominee for governor and former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli has said that the key to lowering property taxes is fixing the school funding formula as well as just fixing the education system altogether. Do you agree with him?
Well, at that level, I think those are components of the fix. I think it's also the school choice. And I think that if we can get a handle on, like I said, you know, sort of reducing, eliminating the duplicity in the administrative side, that would go the furthest, in the sense that we'd be talking about, again, salaries that are way out of proportion. I mean, it used to be the sacred cow every year when we had the school budget proposed in all the different towns. Everybody was like, oh, we have to approve that. It's our children. We have to go yes on the budget. But the budget didn't make it to the classroom. You know, the voting on that didn't help. It went to these administrative positions that were created over the years that just sucked away all of the funding. And we still have, you know, teachers, for example, complaining about having to provide their own supplies or buy their own supplies for a lot of things. In the classroom, it hasn't changed. And that's where we have to direct funding where it will do the most benefit for our children. And that's how I see that happening.
There's a bit of debate about schooling going forward, especially how it relates to the pandemic. Should parents get the option to do virtual learning if they feel uncomfortable sending their kids to in-person learning come September? Because Governor Murphy says it's over. You have to go in-person learning 5 days a week now.
I mean, you know, while I tend to believe that an in-person setting is more productive, I think, like most other things in our platform, it should be the people's choice. Basically, I mean, we know that the mechanism is there now. We also saw some of the flaws of remote learning. You saw children that didn't have their cameras on and were doing other things and totally not paying attention, and the teachers not making it a requirement, for example. So, you know, there are some negatives unless rules are strictly enforced on the remote learning. That being said, I mean, it's kind of like the lockdowns in general and all the mandates. We're very much against the lockdowns to the extent that we've never quarantined the healthy before, but, you know, that doesn't mean if you are sick, you don't feel well, or you're uncomfortable about that, or you're worried about being in a vulnerable population, you should have the choice to stay home and do as many things as you can in that world, for example, related to schooling or work or whatever else. But if people want to go in person, I think they should have that option too. I think there's a lot of benefit there as well. It really should be the choice of each family.
You brought up the lockdowns there. You said that if you were governor, you would end lockdowns. However, the pandemic restrictions have largely been lifted. By the time you would take office, most, if not all, coronavirus restrictions would be behind us. What would there be left for you to undo if you were in that position?
Well, I mean, we've seen the damage done, especially the mistakes in the beginning, including the nursing home fiasco, but there is more to do. Even if we got an order tomorrow from Governor Murphy, because he's concerned about his reelection chances, to say all the orders are rescinded, everything is back to normal, and that's the way it is, we still have the idea of his emergency powers that he has now tried to make permanent with the law that was recently passed. I mean, to me, it's an oxymoron to say permanent emergency power. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. It's an oxymoron. And so I would be attacking the idea that this kind of power, the way it's been wielded this past year for the most part, there's no place for that. It's a clear violation of the ideal of separation of powers that we're supposed to have at all levels. And I think that making those kinds of orders, which amount to creating legislation on the fly as the executive, I mean, that has to be made illegal going forward. It has to be completely turned around so that it can't be done under penalty of immediate removal of office, and depending on the nature of it, potentially even criminal sanction. I mean, the thing is, you have a lot of people who do things in the last few years in particular that are against the Constitution and against the law. And they do not suffer any penalty because of their connection with their political office relative to other people in politics that know them, and all the things that can be done to bury prosecutions or even censures or anything like that. I think it's time that for people to regain their faith in the political mechanism and system, that people who violate the Constitution, there's no gray area for some of these things. It's the same thing with sanctuary city that goes directly against the Constitution. That should be something that disqualifies a person immediately, regardless of the impact to the political parties involved. That has to be dealt with. It has to be shown for what it is. It's a violation, and it's going against one's oath. That should never be swept under the rug, and the fact that it is so often is why we have a public that is totally distrusting and looking at third options like myself.
Are you saying that Governor Murphy should be prosecuted or criminally investigated?
Well, that is a high standard, and I am a lawyer, so I do typically reserve judgment till all the evidence comes in. I would say that, you know, he has made statements about being essentially going beyond or not considering some of the responsibilities he has to the law, Bill of Rights being above his pay grade. Well, no, it's not. And he certainly should be paying some kind of price, whether it's political or otherwise, for his actions that have been violations of his oath of office.
Going back to my original question, in regards to lockdowns, nothing's really locked down at this point. Restaurants open to full capacity, stores, bars, you name it, it's pretty much open in New Jersey for the most part. So what would you be able to do in terms of lockdowns if all the lockdowns are gone by the time you've taken office?
Well, first of all, don't forget that we're at 0.97, and one is the magic number for a lot of things to happen again. The other thing that is still going on is the children and the masks in school. I've been asked to come to a ton of Board of Ed meetings to complain about the fact that we have this situation where the kids are, you know, who are probably the least vulnerable, are still being made, at least in some places, to continue to wear masks when they go back to school in September. Now, at first, everyone was looking to attack Governor Murphy over that because of all the negative health aspects of the masks. So in that respect, we have that fight now Governor Murphy has tried to insulate himself from that by pushing that responsibility down now to all the different boards of ed. So now we have 500 and plus school boards to go to and fight the fight instead of just having the fight focused on his office.
Well, in regards to the masks in schools, the governor did say that that won't be required in September. And then also the fact you have to think of the reason why he's saying that is because that he's expecting the kids will be able to get vaccinated by September. So if there's no masks in school, shouldn't kids need to be vaccinated? How else would they stay safe?
I mean, the school boards have the discretion to require it, first of all, and that's where we have the problem. As far as the vaccination, I mean, if we're going to talk about, first of all, I don't know that we have one that's approved and ready to go yet for the younger of our children. But if we come to the point of that, then whether it becomes mandated with a lot of the other vaccines that they take in their early years, you know, that's a different debate that will probably not happen until after the election. As far as something that's ready enough for that and whether it should become part of an instituted program of vaccines and what the health benefits are. And I'm sure you're going to see people arguing on both sides about that, that it's really gaining them something or it's not. But I mean, the school boards are still making requirements as far as the masks. And that's what, you know, we feel we have to fight that because it's, like I said, return on investment basically is not there and many negative effects. So our thinking is that we're going to be okay and that, you know, we just have to, you know, get out and all live our lives again, and we're going to find out that we're not in such a scary situation for the most part. I mean, the worst of it is over.
We'll have to leave it there. New Jersey Libertarian gubernatorial candidate Greg Mealy, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Sir, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to turn to another candidate. Former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli is the Republican candidate. Cittarelli has largely been behind in this race thus far. The polling has suggested it could be anywhere between 13 and 15 points. However, now this could all change as we move along here, especially with the changes that are coming in regards to mask mandates. Governor Murphy now says that, you know, this September, we're going to be wearing masks in schools. And does that mean there's going to be more mask mandates coming? Well, Cittarelli has strongly said it's up to the parents to make that decision, not the government. Is that an argument that's going to resonate with New Jersey voters? Is the average voter out there saying, you know what, I really don't want to wear a mask. I got my vaccine, since there's about 70% of us who have had at least one dose now, statewide. So I got my vaccine. And the CDC says, well, you don't really need to wear a mask if you're fully vaccinated. That's what was said previously. Why do I need to wear it now? That's what the average voter may be saying out there. If that's the case, can Cittarelli capitalize on that? Well, Cittarelli's largely been unknown at this point, with even many Republicans saying they don't have an opinion on him. Can Cittarelli change the narrative? That's something we're going to be watching as we go into the September and October and basically the fall months here as we're getting into the final stretch of this campaign and we're going into the gubernatorial debate, which is not that far away. It's only about a month, as I said at the top of the show. With the resurgence of masks and COVID, he's looking to change all of this up. He's looking to shake this race up and point to Governor Murphy's failures on COVID. He says it should be an individual choice and not a government mandate. Recently, he picked former state senator Diane Allen as his running mate. Now, some conservatives complained about the choice as they want someone a little more conservative, while many moderates have praised the choice as she has been seen as a centrist who's willing to cross the aisle in order to get things done. I had the chance to catch up with Assemblyman Cittarelli about all the big issues that are facing this campaign. Here's what he had to say. I want to talk about something that you brought up in an interview about a month ago. So in an interview with David Wildstein, you said you would announce your pick for lieutenant governor at the end of June. Well, now we're in July, and I haven't seen anything quite come out about that. So when can we expect to hear who the choice will be?
You have until 30 days after the primary has been certified, which I think takes us into very late July, early August, if I'm not mistaken. So we're going to take the time that we need to make this the perfect choice, and I'm convinced that when I do announce sometime real soon, people in New Jersey are going to be real happy about it.
So also in that same interview, you said you had a list of names who you would be considering. How many names are on this list?
Well, I didn't list anybody during that interview. David Wildstein does, but that's what journalists do, and I understand they have a job to do. So I'm not going to say who's on the list or how many people on the list. What I will say is when I announce, people in New Jersey will be very happy about the choice.
So I know you don't want to say who it is, but what type of person? Are you looking for someone who's been in the legislature? Are you looking for someone who's been another part of government? Or are you looking for someone who may not have any government experience at all?
I'm looking for somebody that could step right into the job, heaven forbid something happened to me. I mean, I'm a cancer survivor. My health is 100% A-okay, or I wouldn't be doing this to myself or my family. But what you learn from being a cancer survivor is that anything can happen at any time. But I have responsibility to the people of New Jersey that my lieutenant governor can step right into the job if something were to happen to me, and that's what my choice will reflect. More than anything, I'm looking for competence.
I want to shift gears here. There's some reporting out there that Belleville Mayor Michael Melham, who's an independent, is set to endorse you. Can you confirm that for us?
Michael has endorsed my candidacy, and I welcome that, but Michael would be the first one to tell you that the only endorsement that matters is the voters. And they'll cast their vote on November 2nd, and things are heating up, not just because it's summertime, but because we've got 3.5 months left in a gubernatorial race. There's only two governor's races in the entire country this year, us and Virginia, and this is critically important to New Jersey. So I'm going to continue to get up and down the state and talk about how I'm going to fix New Jersey. The state we love is broken, and I've got specific ideas on how to fix it. Phil Murphy's policies have only made it worse.
Well, I want to talk about an endorsement that actually, I know you say endorsement shouldn't matter, but it should be more about the voters, but Seaside Heights Republican Mayor Tony Vaz has endorsed Murphy over you. This is a heavily Republican area. Are you worried about what this could mean for Republican turnout in similar parts of the state?
Anybody has a right to endorse anybody they want. Anybody has a right to vote for whoever they want. And I look forward to working with Seaside Heights Mayor Tony Vaz once I'm elected governor.
Now, one more endorsement question. I know how much you love the endorsement questions. You have received an endorsement from former UN ambassador and South Carolina Republican Governor Nikki Haley. She campaigned for you last weekend. Can we expect to see more joint appearances between the two of you?
I would hope so. Nikki and I are very much in sync with regard to a common sense conservative approach to governance. What she accomplished in South Carolina in terms of lowering taxes and creating more jobs is exactly what I want to do here in New Jersey. So I welcome her back anytime she can come. The folks that were in her presence last Sunday very much enjoyed her presence and her words.
Now let's talk about an issue that is affecting a lot of people right now. You recently put out a new campaign ad criticizing Governor Murphy's handling of crime. If you were governor, how would you tackle crime in the state of New Jersey?
Now, look at his policies and what it's doing to New Jersey right now with regard to unemployment and our employers not being able to find people, and also his lack of support for local law enforcement. This progressive talk around the nation of disband and defund police, and here in New Jersey, this governor and this attorney general, or the recently moved on attorney general, have disarmed our police. They've only made their job harder. And local law enforcement need to know that the governor and the number one law enforcement officer in the state, the attorney general, have their back. And that's not the case right now. Directive after directive out of this administration makes things only more difficult for our local law enforcement officers. So as governor, I will not be advocating for us getting rid of qualified immunity. If the George Floyd case murder teaches us anything, a rogue cop is not protected by qualified immunity. And so, but that doesn't mean we get rid of qualified immunity. We don't need civilian review boards with subpoena power. We already have civilian review boards. We've got mayor and councils and township committees. And I'll be supporting our police in a number of other ways. Look what's happening all up and down the Jersey Shore. Our beloved Jersey Shore, we're closing beaches and boardwalks at 9 p.m. at night. we're canceling firework displays because of unruly crowds where our cops are not allowed to go in and do the job the way they always have in the past. They're only allowed to issue warnings to unruly teenagers? Come on. This isn't who we are. We've got to respect the rule of law, and we've got to have the back of local law enforcement. I, as governor, and my attorney general will.
By the time that you take office, most of the health problems associated with COVID-19 will most likely be gone, but the financial ones, they may linger. How would you handle and manage the economic recovery of the state of New Jersey?
I have two primary goals as governor, the first of which is to lower our property taxes. They are the worst in the nation, and that property tax affects every individual, whether they own or rent. It affects every business, whether they own or rent. We need a new school funding formula that provides a flatter and more equitable distribution of state aid for schools. That will lower property taxes and be reflected in my very first budget. Second thing we need to do is create more jobs. And the way to do that is by making New Jersey a much more dynamic and compelling place to do business. New Jersey is the worst state in the union in which to do business. No state is considered more business unfriendly than New Jersey. As an MBA CPA, and two-time Main Street business owner, I know exactly what we need to do to our tax code to create more jobs and make New Jersey a much, much more compelling and dynamic and attractive place to do business.
You brought up the tax code. There's a lot of taxes in New Jersey, obviously, that people don't like. One of them in particular is the gas tax. That's gone up twice within the last few years. Both the Christie and the Murphy administration have raised it. If elected, would you commit to lowering or eliminating the gas tax?
Well, what I'll commit to doing is putting it back on the ballot, because what the Democrats did is kind of built it into the Constitution with automatic increases each year if it doesn't reach certain revenue levels. And that, to me, is a legislature shirking its responsibility. I believe the gas tax should be revisited as need be by the legislature, and then let them be up for re-election every 2 years, and then let the people decide. So, listen, we need a revenue source for infrastructure. Infrastructure is the backbone of the economy. Without a great infrastructure, you won't have a state economy. But at the same time, the way we currently do the gas tax in New Jersey is not sustainable, nor is it fair. Those people that drive electric vehicles don't pay any gas tax. They're using the roads, aren't they?
Congress is now currently debating an infrastructure plan that could provide funds to New Jersey. Governor Murphy says the bill would be a game changer. Do you support the current infrastructure plan being considered in Washington?
I don't know all the details of that, but what I will say is that any infrastructure plan that's passed has to include funding for the Gateway Project. Considering how important New Jersey is to the metropolitan economy, and how important the metropolitan economy is to the national economy, we need to get that Gateway Project funded. And in light of the fact that New Jersey has been a donor state for decade after decade after decade, meaning we send way more in federal taxes to Washington, D.C. than we get back, it's time for the federal government to step up and fund that Gateway Project. And so that's something I would certainly be working in partnership with the New Jersey congressional delegation to get. There's something else I'd be working in partnership with them on. Phil Murphy and the Democrats told us that if Joe Biden was elected president, New Jersey would get the SALT deduction back. Well, Joe Biden's now been the president for more than 6 months, and there's no sign of the SALT deduction coming back. Governor Murphy and the congressional delegation need to advocate more fervently. And if they need to withhold a few votes for Joe Biden's policies in order to get the SALT deduction back, that's what they need to do. That's what I would be demanding as governor.
Now, tolls on the turnpike were raised last year in the middle of the pandemic. Now the residents are traveling down to the shore this summer. Some aren't too happy about it. Would you lower tolls?
And they shouldn't be too happy about it. Now, listen, we need tolls and we need gas taxes to make sure that our roads are safe, our bridges are dependable and safe. We need an infrastructure. But here's what was most insulting about that toll increase. Phil Murphy ordered the hearings on the toll increases that take place during the shelter-in-place order at the height of the pandemic. I mean, talk about adding insult to injury.
You've gone on record saying we need to, quote, unmask the children, close quote, in schools. In September, it's going to be up to each individual district to decide what to do about masks. You've been an advocate for medical freedom and not mandating kids get vaccinated. if students aren't required to get COVID vaccines, how do we protect the kids without them?
I'm vaccinated, but I do not believe in vaccine mandates. I'm vaccinated, and I do not believe in vaccine passports. And I do not believe that anything that's been approved by the FDA for emergency use only, which means it hasn't gone through the usual clinical trials, should not be given to a population that's not vulnerable to that to this virus. And I'm talking about children. And so the science is pretty clear. We don't spread the virus when our schools are open. The data is pretty clear. Remote learning doesn't work. And the reality is pretty clear. Parents want their kids back in school without any mask mandate. That should be optional, up to the family. And I think each school district should approach it in that way. But it would be my hope that school districts would make it optional. So that's where I stand as someone that's running for governor, and that would be my stance as governor.
What about the Delta variant, though? You have to bring that into it because they say that's more contagious now and that the vaccines don't necessarily have the same immunity towards this Delta variant or other variants than the original strain of COVID. So with that in mind, don't we need a way to protect kids from something that we may not know as much about?
That's not what I'm reading or hearing, and I do a lot of the reading and listening. I'm hearing that those that are vaccinated are less inclined to get the Delta variant, that the vast majority of people that get the Delta variant are the unvaccinated, but it is not leading to increases in our ICU units or hospitalizations. So, listen, if you don't want to get vaccinated, there could be ramifications. I don't know, but that's your choice. Okay, we should put the information out there and let people make their choice. I don't think government has a right to demand, to mandate that anyone should have to ingest a medicine, particularly our children. So as long as you don't see, I think, ICU or hospital admissions going up or people dying, I don't know how different this is from the seasonal flu.
Last thing I want to get your take on and see what your thoughts are on is unemployment. It's a big issue for New Jerseyans who lost their jobs during the pandemic. There was trouble claiming benefits, getting someone on the phone from the Department of Labor. It took months for many people to get benefits that they were entitled to. I mean, and this was right in the middle of a pandemic when they need most. They were told, oh, it could take up to 6 to 8 weeks to resolve any issues. If elected, how would you fix the unemployment system in this state?
What we've seen from this administration is incompetency time after time after time. Look at the long lines at motor vehicles. Look at the people waiting month after month after month for their unemployment benefits and not being able to get somebody on the phone. Anyone and everyone who's tried to contact state government has not been able to do so. We've seen them screw up the rollout of the vaccination. Again and time and again, we've seen incompetency. And what we're seeing right now, how is it we're the state with the highest unemployment rate in the nation, and yet there are help wanted signs everywhere? The two are incongruent. And it's because Phil Murphy will not turn off the spigot on unemployment benefits. Now, I'm not saying there aren't hardship cases out there, and we've got to take care of those people who have hardships and make sure they get their unemployment benefits. But I will tell you that too many people are taking the easy way out because Phil Murphy won't turn off the spigot. 33 governors around the state have now refused the $300 booster from the federal government each week for unemployment. My goodness, Phil Murphy's Department of Labor is not even verifying whether or not you're looking for work as a condition of getting your benefits. And this is ruining small business all on Main Street and particularly along the Jersey Shore. So, but at the same time, what this state government needs, I'll be a hands-on CEO, and we will downsize, streamline, and modernize our state government to make sure that these systems work so that any citizen or business that has to engage with state government, it'll be a more user-friendly experience. And so that's my responsibility. We'll not only make state government less expensive, we'll make it much more operationally efficient.
New Jersey Republican gubernatorial candidate and former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli, thank you so much for joining me. And make sure to thank your son Jake for his service. We really appreciate it.
Well, I greatly appreciate it. Melinda and I are blessed with four beautiful children. And our oldest son, second oldest child, is a first lieutenant with the 10th Mountain Division U.S. Army. He just got his marching orders. He'll be deployed in a couple of months. I'm not allowed to say where, but I do greatly appreciate you recognizing him and therefore, in turn, all people that serve our country, past and present and future.
Of course. We'll be watching your campaign. Thank you so much, Assemblyman Cittarelli. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Finally, I want to talk about the incumbent in this race, Governor Phil Murphy. Governor Murphy's term was largely and has largely been defined by the COVID-19 pandemic. This is a crisis that no governor wishes to ever face, nor could ever really see coming. How does a governor prepare, and how does a governor act in this way? We got to see this in full display the past year, with Governor Murphy being tested in a way like no other. And he was largely received praise for his handling of the pandemic. Though Republicans have criticized the lockdowns of businesses such as restaurants and large venues that lost money as a result of these lockdowns, and according to statistics, a third of these businesses will never come back. They've also criticized the deaths that occurred in New Jersey nursing homes, which the Star-Ledger has reported the governor was supposedly warned about. That's the reporting. He was warned that COVID patients could die if he put patients in nursing homes, that the residents of the nursing homes could possibly be at risk and die. The Cittorelli campaign has been desperately trying to poke holes in the response and to attack him on other key issues as well, when it comes to the tolls, when it came to the millionaires tax, property taxes. These are the issues that the Cittorelli campaign thinks that they can galvanize in order to get their voters out there. He also talked about crime extensively, as you just heard when I was interviewing him as we took a look back at that. He extensively wanted to talk about that, especially what's going on in Atlantic City. And, you know, South Jersey, especially Atlantic County, that's a swing county. Cittorelli's got to run it up south if he's going to make the difference. Now, for Governor Murphy, he needs to run it up north. He's got to run it up in Hudson County. He's got to run it up in Bergen County. He's got to run it up in Essex County. He's got to have that Northeast corridor in his pocket ready to go and also do well in the suburbs. Now, Democrats have been doing well in the suburbs as recently as the past election cycle, where President Biden outperformed President Trump in those areas. Now, the question is, can Phil Murphy capitalize on that and keep that trend going? Well, the history for a New Jersey governor who is a Democrat, it ain't too great, because an incumbent Democrat hasn't been elected in the state since 1977. Will Phil Murphy be the guy who changes that? That's what we're going to be really going to be seeing on full display as we go into this debate. Now, although I haven't had the chance to have him on this show yet, which, by the way, we are talking to the governor's office as well as the campaign and trying to make that happen, so we expect and hope to have him on soon, I have spoken to him in the past. Now, I got to talk to him back when I was in college radio. This was right in the middle of when things were really starting to open up. So it was about May 2020, and we talked extensively about, will schools be able to reopen? Of course, we know how the result is, but I want you to really listen in on how he answers the questions, because that could be a preview of what we will be seeing on the debate stage when the moderators ask him questions, when Cittorelli faces him with questions. It's important to see how the governor responds in high-pressure situations, as well as maybe a preview of what policies he'll put in place if he is elected to a second term. Let's take a listen back to what he said. So I want to start off by asking you, you announced this week that outdoor graduations can resume starting July 6th. However, there's a lot of schools that haven't really partaken in that. What's your reaction to that?
I'm not terribly surprised, Joey. This has been one of the most unusual periods in the history of our country, and certainly in the history of our state. So I think people are still coming to grips. I had a son who graduated virtually from college on Saturday, unlike anything any of us have gone through. We'll see. I mean, I think a lot of districts will take us up on it, but we wanted to make sure for the folks who felt strongly about
an in-person ceremony, richly deserved, that they had a chance to do that.
So moving into more colleges and universities, a lot of them are looking to open up starting in for the fall semester. Can Rutgers, can you see Rutgers going back with students in the fall on campus?
I mean, I can't speak for Rutgers, so this is not my point. Can I see higher education as a general matter, including Rutgers, recommencing under some new normal, assuming the health metrics continue to go in the right direction? Yes, I can. I don't think that's a decision we have to make right now, but I do think it's a decision that has to be made, you know, sooner than later. You know, we've signaled that we want to make a decision on pre-K through 12 education by the middle of June. I would have thought that higher education would be in a similar timetable, but I would hope that we can. And is that still a possibility? Absolutely.
Now, there's many people who have said that the only way to do this is by the creation of a vaccine for COVID-19. Is that something that you agree with, or do you think there's other mitigation efforts that can be used to make this happen?
I don't think we're going to have a vaccine by the fall. So, and I say that as a non-medical expert, but based on all the inputs that we get and all the people with whom we speak, from Tony Fauci on down through the system. So that's first point. I don't think we should be predicating anything on a vaccine this fall. And believe me, if I'm wrong, I'll be the happiest guy in New Jersey, if not America. I do think, however, that we have right now an awareness and an infrastructure that we didn't have a couple months ago. So awareness in meaning that social distancing has become kind of a new normal, that we don't shake hands and hug and kiss like we used to, that we're wearing face coverings, we're washing our hands with soap. So there's a behavioral change that just wasn't there a few months ago. And then secondly, there's really three things here that's different. Secondly, we've got the testing, and we will have the contact tracing infrastructure in place that we just didn't have as a country or as a state. We're now doing over 20,000 tests a day. That means, why is that important? That means we can quickly spot a flare-up. The contact tracers can get on the phone and figure out who else might be infected. And then there's a plan for isolation, so you could basically corner or ring fence any flare-ups. And then thirdly, while I'm pretty sure I'm right about vaccines, I'm not sure I'm right that there won't be therapeutics. The drugs are becoming increasingly available. I'm not a medical expert, and I can't promise you when, but when I say available for COVID-19, not for, hey, it works on malaria, we think it might work on COVID-19. No, I mean something that's literally tested, has gone through trials, and is directly for COVID-19 complications. So for all those reasons, and as much as I would be dying for a vaccine, believe me, I think we can figure out a way to get through this until we get one.
So going off of that, what do you think the parameters would look like for a possible reopening of universities and colleges in the fall, pending that the health and safety is in line with that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I know yet, to be honest with you. I'm not sure anyone really knows, Joey. I mean, my daughter is a rising third year at University of Virginia. I just saw some information that came out from there. I've got a son who's going to be a sophomore at Princeton. I'll be on a board call with them on Saturday. Clearly, Rutgers, new president Jonathan Holloway is on our reopening recovery commission. I think it's I'll tell you what I think is the hardest nut to crack, particularly given we have gone from nowhere to almost leading the nation in testing. We'll have a very robust contact tracing and isolation program in place. The biggest nut to crack in education, period, not just Rutgers or higher ed, is unwitting asymptomatic transmittal of the virus from young, healthy people to older educators, professors, administrators, and or to folks who have other underlying health challenges. That's what I think we all collectively have to plan best for. So that could be, you know, certainly social distancing. It could be virtual. It could be a combination of a number of things. That, to me, is the biggest question yet to be answered.
Now, moving into college sports, obviously a big market for these schools, especially Rutgers, and especially since the uncertainty with whether students are going to be back in the fall here. Do you see college sports coming back? And if so, with or without fans?
Again, probably, Joey, too early to tell. I would hope we could see college sports back, but you've also got not just what New Jersey thinks. You've got, in Rutgers' case, you've got Big Ten questions and what other schools are doing. I saw the president of Michigan the other day say that if students aren't back on campus, they couldn't see having sports being played. Forget for a minute about whether or not that is something that would work for Rutgers. You know, if you take Michigan off the field, then you've got, you know, how do you deal with that as a conference? I would love, we're going to give, you know, we've given guidance on professional sports. We're going to give guidance, I think, in the next number of days on other sports. I would love to see us back in business on sports for a number of reasons, including our mental health, reasons. If we could do it responsibly and safely, count me in. Will there be fans? I think it's too early to say one way or the other. I don't think we need to make that decision now. And frankly, I don't think we can make it now. I will say this, that out of doors sports and activities are easier to deal with than indoors. And so that's something that I think we all have to keep in mind. I read something yesterday, the virus is 19 times more likely to connect indoors than it is outdoors. And I think we have to keep things like that in mind.
Now, I know you said that you were talking with incoming Rutgers president Jonathan Holloway, but in regards to college sports, have you been in any contact with athletics director Pat Hobbs?
I've not spoken to Pat about this yet. I have not. I've spoken to Coach Schiano and congratulated him on an extraordinary spring recruiting season, in both for his class of 20 and class of 21. But the answer is not yet.
So Rutgers is obviously taking a big financial hit as a result of the pandemic. Is the state in any way looking into ways to help out with that, whether it's lobbying for federal funds or directing direct state funds into helping state universities?
Yeah, I mean, all of the above. We already have, and we will continue to, getting federal assistance for higher ed, frankly, directly to the state of New Jersey, to municipalities, counties, education more generally. We can't do it alone. There's no amount of money any American state has that can make up for the hole that's been created by, you know, this is the biggest health crisis in our country's history, and it's the biggest now economic crisis in our country's history, and that hits in every corner of our economy and society, and including in education, specifically in higher ed. So we'll do everything we can as a state, but we need the feds in a big way.
Finally, here on the regards to masks, you've been saying, you even said at your press conference yesterday that it's a big game changer and that a lot of people should be doing, especially in Hong Kong, since they had a lower amount of deaths as a result, only 4. So what is your message to people who say, I don't want to wear a mask, especially maybe those listening to the program, or even the fact, what is your thoughts on trying to get N95 masks to everyone?
Yeah, I don't know that you need an N95. Obviously, that's the Rolls Royce of masks. But I think face coverings generally that cover your nose and your mouth and don't allow a lot of leeway or space between the face covering and your face. I mean, I think it's going to become part of the new normal. Not necessarily always, but it's going to be, certainly until we have a vaccine, it's going to be something that we're going to find much more natural as we go forward. You know, they weren't wearing them. There were some in Hong Kong. I shouldn't say they weren't wearing them. But, boy, when bird flu came through and SARS came through, it became a natural act. And so it was very easy for them, the residents there, I lived there for a few years of my life. It was very easy for them to reflectively put the face covering on. You know, think back to pre-9/11 and all the differences in the, what the world looked like then, and the standing in the TSA line at the airport and taking your shoes off, and all, you know, none of us wanted to do that either, but it's become part of our regular habit because we know it's the right thing to do. And I think this face covering, social distancing, washing hands with soap and water, not shaking hands and hugging as much, I think that's all going to be part of our new normal going forward.
Governor Phil Murphy, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to me today. I really appreciate it.
Are you always. Thank you, Joey.
Well, that about wraps it up for me today. If you want to keep in touch with me and everything that's going on the show, all you have to do is follow me on Twitter, @block_Joey. Again, it's @block, and my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram @joey.block.39. Again, that is @joey.block.39. And if you ever miss an episode of this show, which you shouldn't, but let's say you do and you want to take us to the beach, or on, you just want to have us in the car, or really anywhere you're going, well, all you got to do is go to WCTCAM.com, go to the podcast section, and then look for In the Middle. You'll see my name, Joey Block, and you can listen to all the past episodes there. You can also download them. So like I said, you can take them on the go with you. You're going for a walk, you're going to the beach, you're going on a nice car drive. You got In the Middle at your disposal. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Joey Block, and this has been In the Middle. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on 1450 WCTC.